stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm giving most of this show over to an interview I did with Doug Jones, who is currently appearing in three different plays that are now on stage at the Oslo Repertory Theater in Sarasota, Florida: The Life of Galileo, Perfume Shop, and Hearts. And in Hearts, Doug is not only the star, but he is never off the stage. It's an incredibly challenging and amazing performance. And in this show, I'm also going to play a review of both Perfume Shop and Hearts. This is a very, very thoughtful interview in which Doug talks not only about the challenge of playing these three very, very different roles, but also about his philosophy of acting and how he became an actor. So hang on. Here comes the show. Welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about finding, discovering who you really are, and then becoming it. If you've been listening, you know that as a psychotherapist, and actually even as a person, I've become aware that most of us are hiding qualities of our own. We're hiding parts of ourselves. Parts of ourselves which, for one reason or another, we decided were not okay. Unfortunately, we're not only hiding these things from the rest of the world, from other people, but we got really good at hiding these things from ourselves. Now, it takes a lot of energy to suppress parts of yourself. So even if the only benefit was that you would then have access to more energy if you could know all of who you are and use all of who you are, that would be a good enough reason. But I believe that just because we decided a particular quality wasn't going to work, was going to get us into trouble, perhaps. That doesn't mean that that quality is actually bad. It may, in fact, be a quality we badly need later in our lives, or right now. So the ability to discover all that you are and then decide whether or not to use it and free up all that energy is what this show is about. And one of the ways that I think helps people discover how they are, who they are, is by hearing from other people who have. And to this end, I do a series called Anatomy of an Artist, in which I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And I do that because, at least in those areas, in the area of their art, these people are exactly who they are. You could not be dedicated to an art in this culture if it wasn't exactly who you are. Because we make it very difficult in this culture for artists, as if you've been listening, you have heard. Today, I am playing an interview I did with Doug Jones, a remarkably talented and professional actor, part of the professional company at the Oslo Repertory Theatre Company. And this season, Doug is appearing in three plays, The Life of Galileo, The Perfume Shop, and Hearts, three very, very different characters. And in this interview, he will talk not only about those characters, but about how he became an actor and his philosophy of acting. And I'm also playing a review by Sharon Leslie of two of those plays. If you were listening 2 weeks ago, you heard an interview with Michael Edwards on The Life of Galileo and Sharon's review there. But today, it'll be Sharon's review of Perfume Shop before Doug's interview and her review of Hearts afterwards. And so here now, Sharon's review followed by Doug's interview.
Hi, this is Sharon Leslie with review of The Perfume Shop. Sweet florals, tangy citrus, spicy herbals, and animal musks are the various scents one might attribute to the storyline of The Perfume Shop. This charming play, written in 1937 by Hungarian playwright Miklós László, is getting its first English language production in the United States with a deliciously delightful production at the Oslo Repertory Theater. You may have already seen several versions of this play made into films like The Shop Around the Corner, In the Good Old Summertime, and most recently the loose adaptation, You've Got Mail. But the original is worth seeing. Watching The Perfume Shop made me appreciate the artistry of a good playwright. It's hard to write a romantic comedy with charm, wit, and humanity. This play has differences from the films that are appealing, and the characters come alive as portrayed by the Oslo actors. Foremost is Paul Whitworth as Miklós Hammerschmidt, the perfume shop owner. The character has to go through some fairly tough issues. Whitworth embodies the wide range of emotions that his character goes through with ease and appeal. He makes it easy for us in the audience to identify with Hammerschmidt's problems. Jason Bradley sparkles as the young man who has fallen in love with his girl pen pal, whom he has never met, or so he thinks. Mackenzie Kyle brings passion to her portrayal of the woman he is writing to, but hates in person. Other notables are Ghafir Akbar as the young bicycle delivery boy. He energizes the stage and fills the production with a marvelous sense of comic style. Also, Doug Jones as the passive-aggressive older clerk adds a different dimension to the story aspects with the comings and goings in and out of the perfume shop. The set by Jeffrey Dean is evocative of the 1930s in Eastern Europe, displaying the soft beauty yet functionality of a perfumery. Costumes by Virgil Johnson are gently period and lovely to watch. What I like the most was the charm and humanity that came through, first with the play, and then with the actors as they brought their characters to life. Like a sweet yet tangy scent, the perfume shop should please anyone who goes to see it.
Usually, I begin my interviews by saying, now I'm here with whoever it is I'm interviewing and where I am. But for some reason, I didn't do that with Doug. We just started right in talking. I'm telling him what it is I do, you know, about the show and what we're going to do. But I never say who he is or where we are. So here is my interview with Doug Jones, and we are in the rehearsal studio at the Oslo Repertory Theatre.
I do this internet radio show. I don't know how much they told you. They didn't tell you any of the right to show up.
That's right.
I know. Yeah. I know. It's.
No, they didn't tell me anything.
Well, okay. I do an internet radio show.
Okay.
And I interview people who make their living or their life with their art.
Mm-hmm. That's me.
I know that's you. I know that that's very definitely you. I'm making a lot of noise here because I'm moving the mic around. Okay. Hopefully it won't be too terrible. I always start by asking the same question, and that is, how did it happen? How did it get you? How did you get it? How did it start?
Well, it was a long, long time ago.
Yeah.
And my dad was working for the State Department, and we lived in Costa Rica. And I was speaking Spanish before I spoke English.
Wow.
Anyway, we moved back to this country when his job ended.
How old were you? Three.
And I'm 3 and 4, and I'm trying to learn English. And one of the things my parents did was put me in a little drama class that they had at John Carpenter's Hall. And I took drama classes and made friends and learned English all at the same time. So I was really doomed, you know, right from the beginning.
Because it was your introduction to the United States. It was your... It came with all this lovely stuff, like friends and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And an interest in the theater. And, of course, it was an imaginative teacher, which was also a plus. And
you were very young.
I was young, yeah. I was, and I think I might have done my first play. You know, I might have been 4 or 5, and then I did plays always. I was in plays in school and community theater, which is something I could always do, although I considered other professions, and I thought about medicine, I thought about the law and so forth, but I was always in the theater.
Yeah.
And I was always doing a play, so...
And how were your parents about that?
They were fine with it. It was their fault.
Yeah, right. So they could take take the blame and the responsibility and all that. Your fault, right?
I had nothing to do with it. I was, you know, I mean, the only parallel story I can think of is... somebody like Diego Rivera, who was drawing on his walls all the time when he was a little boy, and he's a great muralist, of course, mm-hmm. And so his father bought all this butcher paper and put it up on his walls.
To protect the walls.
To save the walls, but also to facilitate his drawing.
Yeah,
to
right.
Keep them and all right. of that. Didn't stifle that little boy's creativity.
No. No, you know, but a lot of parents who are... perfectly happy to see a kid dancing, singing, drawing, whatever, are not so happy to see them.
Yeah, I wonder why that is. That's too bad. Yeah, because I think the creative outlet is a great gift that people have, and it's generational. I mean, you pass this on to your children. If you can play the piano very well, most likely, you know, you're going to have somebody in the family playing the piano, too.
So do you have kids?
Yeah, I have two kids. I have two grown-up kids.
Have you passed it on?
Well, you know... They both love the theater. They are not involved in the theater, but the theater is part of their lives, and that's really all I can ask of anybody, that they consider the arts as something they should see and participate in wherever they are.
To see the value in it.
Well, yeah, it connects them to life and to people and in a way that nothing else does.
Boy, I know. Mm. So, okay, so now we have you at 4.
Yeah.
And we have you doing plays in school. So then what happened?
Well, I went to high school and I did more plays, and I started getting some recognition. I was named best actor a couple of years in a row in Colorado, and I had some scholarships, although I didn't take them up on it. I went to a little liberal arts college in the Finger Lake region in New York, a place called Hobart College. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, a liberal arts person.
Wait a minute. So you were offered scholarships. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming you're saying that they were for certain schools and you didn't want to go there.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
Okay, that's all.
So why did you choose Hobart?
Well, it was a school that was suggested at home by my parents and where I was going to church at the time. And it was a little Episcopal school.
You can be an actor, but don't get away from the faith.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. Anyway, it was a good liberal arts college. And
so did you just major in, what did you major in?
English, finally. I was an English major.
I see.
Which was a great major there, mm-hmm. and they had terrific professors, and I was very happy to read poetry under the trees. And, mm-hmm. That's where I met my wife, as a matter of fact.
Oh, very nice.
Yeah.
Reading poetry under the trees.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, pretty much. That's mm-hmm. right. And, you know, it's kind of a great major for a drama person because, you know, you're involved with a lot of literature, and then you get to act
words.
It out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of spiritual, really. You're making the words flesh. You are acting out what is written.
Yeah.
And you're becoming what is written.
Right. And it does come from a love of the words.
Absolutely. And stories.
And stories. Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
So you're kind of immersed in both of them.
That's right.
Right. Right.
Well, stories, yes. Well, that's what a play is. It's a story that's acted out. It's no more, no less, really. And that's one of the things I think as human beings we do best. We tell stories about what's happened to us, what's happened to our friends and family, mm-hmm. what our life has been like, what somebody else's life has been like. I mean, this all falls into storytelling.
Yes.
And into a kind of narrative of the human race. And
it's what we have to offer each other, right?
That's it.
Right.
Well, it's how we do it.
Yeah.
It's how we
interact.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
That's how we do it.
It's how we do it. It's exactly right. And so so you came out of college mm-hmm. as an English major.
Well, no. I left college in the middle of it because my college was so small. I mean, 300 men. It was tiny. it didn't have a drama department, and that's what I was doing all the time. And so I considered at the time British drama schools. I really didn't know any American drama schools, and I didn't want to go to California. And Juilliard, I think, was in its first year, and I didn't really know too much about it. And the acting that I admired at the time were people like Tom Courtenay and the British actors who seemed to be able to do everything.
Yeah.
They could do the classics and modern stuff. And I thought, well, I just need to do more of that. And so I didn't know anybody. I just wrote away for the prospectus of the Guildhall School, and I got it back, and it sounded good to me because they kept the Americans together. They didn't split them up as they do now. I auditioned at Brooklyn Academy of Music. This wonderful fellow called Roger Brown is no longer with us. And I was accepted, and so I went over there, and I was the only American in my class, and I was a British drama student for 2.5 years. So,
oh, but that was terrific.
It's perfect training for preparation for what we do here.
Yeah.
For repertory, because we do everything.
Right.
And so they didn't worry about my being an American, because I could do that on my own, but I learned about Shaw and Shakespeare and European theater.
More good stories.
Sort of the Western civilization of how to act in the English language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, all right. So you come out of that,
mm-hmm.
and
I come out of that, and I go back to Hobart and get an English degree.
You know what, forgive me, I'm thinking about the first line in Avenue Q. You know, I graduated with a degree in English, and what do I do now, you know?
Anything.
Yeah.
Well, I think education is the point, you know? Getting
developing
all right, a sensibility.
So now you've got this this foundation.
Yeah.
Of the stories of the world, essentially, right?
Yes.
And the training you can't get better training than you got, right?
No,
right.
That's right.
So here you are.
Yeah.
You emerge at what I'm guessing is to be
23, something like that.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
And
I started in rep. I auditioned in New York. I think, what did I do? I wrote away to all the repertory theaters in this country. There, I think there were 30 of them then. And now I think there are much more, maybe three times more. Many more theaters. But there were 30 then, and I got two responses. And then I got an audition, and I got a job at Baltimore Center Stage, which is, turned out to be a major rep. I didn't know much about it, but I sure like Baltimore. And I was there for a year and in the season. And the next year I was at Cleveland Playhouse at Case Western, and I was there for quite some time. I was about there 4.5 years. And that really cemented my repertory experience, because it was a theater that had three theaters, a revival, classic revival house, a new play, Black Box, and a commercial house, a Broadway house. And so Richard Oberlin, who was the artistic director, could program a resident company of 15 people into all these three plays. And if you just spent a year in the commercial house, then, well, you're ready for new plays. And he would switch you over to that, and he would move you around. A very terrific artistic director that we will not see his like again. So it was really more training, you know, in the repertory. And I was very grateful. I met a lot of people and repertory actors and directors that came through there. Richard Oberlin, just as a sideline, is the only artistic director that I know of that arrived at the Cleveland Playhouse, which was the oldest and largest repertory theater in the country, and as an apprentice, and did every job there. Before he became artistic director, he worked in the shop and in the costume shop. He did every single job.
Yeah, you're right. You won't see that like again.
No, those guys are gone.
Yeah. Even that way of thinking is gone. Mm-hmm. You know, that that attitude or approach, or I don't actually have the right word, that philosophy of what is, how a person should be.
Yes.
You know.
That's right. Should know everything about your business.
Yeah. I remember my father, who manufactured belts, who said, you know, he swept the floor, he did whatever had to be done in his business, he knew how to do it.
Yes.
You know. But that's not...
I know. maybe we'll get back to that, because there's so many virtues about doing that. When I, just switching over to my English major, I read Life in the Mississippi a couple summers ago, thinking I'd read it in college, and I thought I'd pick up again, and I started reading it, and it was Mark Twain here talking about every twist and turn in the river, and I thought, this is boring. Why is he doing this? We're just being subjected to every little eddy and every little sandbar and every little, and then finally, you know, the light goes off in my head. Mm-hmm. That this is the metaphor, that if you're entrusted with something like your life or in the lives of somebody else,
wow,
you better know everything about what you're doing.
Yes. Yeah, it's the whole...
And what's moving about it is that he takes the time to do that. It's like sitting down with your grandchild and saying, this is where all the money is, and this is where the relationships are, and this is where you come from, and this is your family, and this is... It's somebody taking the time with you, and in this case, the reader, which is all of us, and leading us through, you know...
This is how you do it.
This is how you do it, and this is what it's about, and I know how to do it.
Right.
And I can take you through it. That kind of responsibility that I think we've also lost of artists taking care of their craft and taking care of the audience.
Do you think, I mean, I'm leaping, but do you think that that's because fame, success, whatever that is, has become so important that craft...
Mm. There's certainly some of that. It's kind of celebrity at all costs these days. And you see it reflected everywhere.
Well, the reality show.
Yes, exactly.
You know,
or the non-reality
or the
show.
Right.
Because, you
right.
Know,
or
who lives like that?
The insane reality show.
It's a something they conjure up and contrive and call it reality.
Reality, yes. Well, and isn't that a metaphor for the whole thing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That it isn't real.
No, it isn't.
It isn't real.
Yeah.
It's interesting, and for me, you know, really important. The theme of the show that I do is... discovering who you really are and then becoming it.
Mm.
The reason that I interview artists is because it is my personal belief that if you're an artist in this culture, it's because it's who you really are, because You wouldn't do that unless...
And there's an artist in everybody.
Yes, and that's the point.
Yeah.
To find that.
Well, anyone who's worked with children or observed children know that.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
And it's one of the reasons that art speaks to us, too, because it's not that removed. I mean, oh, I could do that, I could see that, or I understand that, or that speaks to me. I can participate in that. It speaks to the artist in you in the way that maybe a religious man speaks to the spirituality in you when he makes this little bow to you. The spirit in me acknowledges
the spirit in you. The artist in me acknowledges artist in you.
Yeah.
That's very lovely. And I've never heard anybody say that.
Okay, you heard it here.
All right. I've seen Perfume Shop and Hearts. And I've seen you in a lot of stuff.
Oh,
but this year, I have seen both of those.
A lot of diversity.
Ooh.
Yeah.
And so will you talk about them, about how you do that shift?
Well, how is really a great word, because it's all about the how, and it's a place where you incorporate your observation and your reading and your imagination and your response to the script and move all the molecules toward that end, toward what that person is doing and looking. And it's a kind of a mystery and a detective story based on what the person does and what he doesn't do, what he says and what he doesn't say, what people say about him, who's lying, who isn't, your response to the kind of language that comes out of his mouth. It's all of those things together that you assimilate over time and in rehearsal, and put together this character, hopefully, that is more or less different than anything else you've done.
So are you describing the Mark Twain approach to character development?
Well, yeah, I guess
I
am.
Mean?
Yeah, well, mm-hmm. Although, you know, in a rep situation, we really don't have,
you don't have
all
the
that,
time,
all
right.
that kind of time. I think he was talking just generally about being
an artist.
No, but
it does sound like you are looking at every aspect that you can.
That you can. To
find him.
Well, and to, you know, be true to the function of this person. You're this part of the story, and to have that occur.
Oh, okay, so just for the purposes of letting people know, as there is an audience here, would you say a little bit about the character in Perfume Shop and then talk about Hearts?
Oh, Shipos, yes. Well, the name itself tells you something.
Adorable. It's true.
Shipos, she's kind of sheepish. A very kind man, the oldest man in the shop. Think of the perfume shop as a metaphor for the theater, and you'll understand my position. He's the oldest man in the perfume shop, and he is a mentor and befriends the younger folks, and keeps his eye on the doings of the shop and knows his stuff. He is a little bit of a church mouse in the sense that he's afraid of losing his job. He has so much to lose. He has a wife and three children. Times are tough out there in Budapest pre-World War II. And this shop is a kind of a bright, special little world that people feel safe and comfortable in. It's almost a pre-war luxury, a kind of formality and kindness that the customers and the people who work there enjoy. It's its own special world. Outside is much grimmer. There are drums of war coming. Who knows how many of those people will survive? Gosh, it sounds like Fiddler on the Roof now. But it's a much more difficult world where people do starve and there is unemployment and there are bad things. Inside, it's beautiful. Outside, not so much. Or a cabaret.
I was just thinking a cabaret.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So that is kind of the setting, and he is enmeshed in everyone's stories, partly because he's a little bit of a busybody, and partly because there's nothing much else going on besides selling perfumery objects,
yes.
Soaps and unguents of all kinds. And he's a bright little fella, and he sees the relationships, and he sees the ups and downs of the shop and who's in love and who isn't, which is the most interesting thing in any group of people. And so he helps these two people find each other, even though they have already found each other and they can't even admit it. But he's also involved in the shop owner's story and everyone's story.
In everyone's story.
He's like Touchstone.
Yeah, and he sees the flaws.
Yes.
As well as the, you know, he sees the wounds and the pain and as well as the burgeoning romance.
That's right. Yeah. Yes.
And he's kind about it to the extent that he can be, right?
He means no harm.
Well, he means no harm. That's exactly right. He's very sweet, and it's clear when you talk about him how fond you are of him.
Well, you know, in the theater, in this situation, it could very easily be me.
Oh my God.
I'm the oldest in the shop.
Are you? and so
in the of the acting company.
That was a sweet thing to say. That was a gift to me. Thank you. So if you don't want to say anything else about it, I'll understand. But I do think you probably do mentor those who come at.
I mentor anybody who
will let you.
Who will let me.
Yeah.
If they want it, fine. If they don't, fine.
Yeah.
But we are assigned mentee.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yes, we are. With the associate company, the resident company, which is not too many of us anymore. But we are. And
who do you mentor?
Nisa, I mentor, and Hannah, I mentor.
Wow.
But I mentor all of them. I mean,
I'm sure you do.
Yeah.
Do you also observe in the way that Shipos does the doings, the pain, the burgeoning romances?
I try to resist the paranoia that he has, you know, about his own situation. I hope I don't take myself quite as seriously as he does. It's kind of life and death with Shipos a little bit.
Well, but it is life and death.
Yes.
I mean, if he doesn't have this job, there may not be another.
That's true. That's true, but I'm just saying there are differences between
Yeah, forgive me. There's very little chance that if this is not your job, that you will not have another. I will say anybody who's ever seen you work knows how terrific you are. I mean, and how valuable you are in any company. So, wow.
Thank you. I just don't take anything for granted. I try not to.
That's another. Less than popular point of view, I would think, these days.
Yeah, I don't think it's a good thing to take things for granted or to assume something that is not,
that you don't know.
For sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Things can change on a dime.
Yes, they can. They can. And some of that, I mean, in a way, Perfume Shop is the perfect example of that, because who's the young man? What's his name?
Jason.
No, I mean, what is he?
Horvath.
Horvath, right.
Yeah.
I mean, one day he's the treasured
employee,
almost son, yeah. Right? And then the next day he's persona non nothing.
Yeah, people think he's having an affair with the boss's wife.
Exactly,
but
he doesn't know that.
Yeah.
And it's an example of that. You never know what's coming because
through no fault of your own.
Exactly.
Exactly. I remember coming down here to Sarasota in 1982 with my wife and my little boy, who was then three. He's 31 now.
Wow.
And it was the perfect place. But not because I researched it and I knew that it was the perfect place. I discovered that it was the perfect place. I was completely lucky about coming to
Sarasota. You know, I hear that story a lot from artists. That there's a serendipity, that there's a you know, there's a Yiddish word for it. It's bashert.
Yes.
Do you know bashert?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. So that there's that factor in so many people that I interview. That it's as though this was, you know, meant, and you just fell in it, you know. And I mean, really, you fell into that drama school, didn't you?
Yes, in a way.
I mean, they could have done any number of things to help you learn English. They didn't need to do that.
A little drama class, yeah. That's right.
I mean, so even from the beginning, I mean, and really, you sort of got led.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
With kind of blind man's...
That's right.
You know,
through no great brilliance on my own, I followed the path that was open to
Well,
me.
I think that that's... forgive me, but I think that is a kind of brilliance. I think that a lot of people are afraid of that, unwilling to trust that, unaware.
It's kind of an Eastern thing to follow the path of least resistance, in a sense, in that teaching. And to like something that likes you back is another way of putting it.
Yes, yes, and to follow the road
that's lit.
That's exactly right. Okay, so a little bit about Hartz,
yes.
A little bit about that character.
Hartz. Willie Holtzman's dad. This was so much of the experience in Hartz was just taken from Willie's father, Willie Holtzman being the author of this play, and there's a site on the internet, Stuff My Dad Says, or something like that, Things My Father Says, and you can type in, and it's kind of, this play is like that. I mean, this is Willie's father. This is why the language of the play is so authentic and intimate, you know, because it's just, I can just see it.
And powerful, oh my God.
Written down.
Right.
And the directness and the strength that he has, although he's quite eccentric, but that whole notion of talking directly to somebody and talking directly to an audience, and it doesn't matter if it's one person or 1,000 people, you know, he'd be the same.
Right. This is what he's got to say.
That's who he is.
That's right.
To honor that. And absolutely himself in every situation. And it's kind of astonishing in that sense, because it plays about so many things. And because it's an intergenerational play, it's a play about the times from the late 30s into the present day. We see Donald Waldman, my character, grow up and grow old, and it's almost a highlight of a reel of his difficult and traumatic moments in his life, and how he copes, and how he's stuck in certain situations, and how he copes with that. In that sense, it's like Chekhov. No big ideas, but here's a situation that somebody's stuck in, and how does he deal with it?
And how does everybody else around him deal with him and how he's dealing with it?
That's right.
And the impact that he has on others, and they on him.
Right.
And that, the very sweet aspect of the that lifelong friendship, that I think is not that common, actually.
No, it's not.
Especially for men.
No, that's right.
Right.
Exactly. There's one woman in his life, and his set of friends that he knew growing up.
Right. And really, how he starts is how he goes. Mm-hmm. You know, his life.
That's right. So it bespeaks a tremendous amount of loyalty on his part, and appreciation, and the people. Those people in the ensemble got him through.
Yes.
And he returns that with his love and his loyalty.
And everything he's got.
And his humor.
Yes.
Right, of course.
Everything he's got. And they do too.
Yeah.
They do too.
Yeah. Just honesty. Because if he's annoyed with him, he'll yell at him too.
Yeah. That's right. You know,
he doesn't take any guff.
No, he doesn't.
No nonsense.
No.
It's true. He'll have fights.
You're right. But it's part of their dynamic, isn't it? His always teasing the guy with the queens and the pants, Herbie. Right.
Well, it's such an unlikely group of people, and it's the kind of thing that only you would have if you were friends from childhood, because they're not necessarily people that you might pick out of, you know, your Amherst class, or a wise guy, or a guy with a speech impediment, or you know, just ordinary people, really.
But they were, it's that thing, they were thrown together as children.
That's
and
right.
They just, and whatever it was that happened to them as children.
They went with it.
Yeah, right. It glued them.
That's right.
It glued them.
The shared experience.
Yeah. And as you say, this particular play is about everything. I mean, it's about the socioeconomic picture of our world from the 30s to the 80s?
From a particular point of view, from a working class point of view, it's a little man's view of the world. I mean, he's not a son of West Point or anything like that, but a street kid.
Yeah, but...
And that sense of place of St. Louis, with lots of local references of Hodemont and Cahokia Downs. And,
yeah, that didn't mean anything to me.
Yeah, but it's very particular, and you know that
this is
very authentic.
There, right, you know it's a place.
You know
right.
It's a specific place, and this play has an authentic voice.
Okay, so now Don is nothing like Sheepish.
No, not really.
So,
except they, I think they are both kind and can be capable of kind. And in a larger sense, they are alike. I know when we pay homage to people, you know, it's so hard thinking of their particular virtues that were unlike anybody else's. And of course, they are like so many other people. And Shakespeare kind of solved this problem by saying, let me see, what was he like? He was as tall as he hath height and as broad as he has breath, but the tears of him are wet.
Right.
So it's a common humanity.
Right. We're universal.
We are universal.
Yeah. I'm fond of saying to I'm a therapist, and sometimes people will say to me, "Is this normal?" And I will say, "If you do it, everybody. Not. I mean, you can't do anything the rest of us can't do."
Well, when you're getting into human nature and human activity, you're getting into some pretty broad areas.
Yes.
There.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, people are so wonderful and pretty creepy too.
Yes. Well, but the thing is that you can't. None of us can be anything that other people can't be. You can't
really
be something a person isn't.
That's right.
You know,
that's
I mean,
exactly
you, right. Whatever it is, you know you share that.
It's human-like.
That's correct. It's human-like.
It is. Right. Again, I go to Shakespeare when these Richard II, they're looking for a man to kill the children in the tower. Mm. And they find these guys, and this one fella says, well, you know, I don't pull a cart, and I don't eat oats. If it be man's work, I'll do it.
Yeah, right. He's not a horse.
Not a horse.
He's a man.
I can do it.
All right, I'm a man. Right, yeah, exactly.
Not anybody you necessarily want to be,
yeah,
but
right, right.
He is a man.
Right, exactly. And he's right.
He is right.
He's right.
He's dead right.
Right. Okay, so now, how did you find Don? I mean, let me say this. It's an extraordinary performance. Whatever you say about ensemble, you're on that damn stage.
Mm, long time.
All the time.
I don't leave it.
No, and it's incredibly stressful stuff that you're doing. Mm. And it's and you move through all of the whatever it is he's feeling, you know, it's there and it changes and it's and I mean you never get to go off and you know, regroup.
No, you know, you just again. I'm lucky to use all the experience I've had as an actor to keep myself unassuming that this is happening for the very first time. Even though we know where it's going to go, we kind of don't, and it's important that we don't.
Yeah, we stay in the moment.
And we don't tip our hands in the story, and it's a story that happens. In story theater, which is almost pure theater, I grab a hat and I'm now this person, or I have this conversation. And I say, now we're in 45, now we're in 45, and now we're in 1968, now we're in 1968. And you just have to accept that.
And not only are you in 1968, but you're the guy you were in 1968.
You try.
Who is not necessarily the guy you're going to be, right?
No, you think about how he sounded as a young guy.
Right.
And where that goes over the years, and you try it out, you practice.
And you bounce back and forth.
And you bounce back and
oh
forth.
Oh, my God.
And you do what's required of you in the story.
If it's a man's work, right?
It's man's work, you can do it.
That's right.
It's written down, I'm supposed to be able to do it.
And you do. No, you do. It's really extraordinary. And I will... There'll be I have a reviewer who'll be doing a review of both of these plays, and I know what she's going to say, and I know that you'll all come and see them, because they're amazing, and you are amazing.
Oh, thanks.
No, thank you. So I like to ask, is there anything that I didn't ask you that I should have, and or is there anything you want to say about what it is really like to make a life within art?
Oh my goodness, these are unanswerable. It's certainly been my life. I can't imagine life doing anything else, really, that I would be happy with. I will say that I'm just as happy and just as satisfied, which I think might be maybe a difficult thing to appreciate. A piece, a small part or a middle-sized part can be just as challenging and just as satisfying as a part that is tour de force. In a way, you're on stage and you have an ability to judge where it's going and the climate and the atmosphere of the response, and you have more time. If you're playing a smaller part or a middle-sized part, you don't have any time. You just have time to paint the color blue or paint green, not too much, and to move at the pace that the play is at. And that's hard to measure if you're not on stage, not to speed it up, not to slow it down, but to be...
Because somebody else is controlling the pace.
That's right, and there's and the audience, too. It's always you, the night, and the music, because an audience brings its own dynamic.
Oh, I love this.
Its own dynamic to a play, and some audiences are a little more cerebral and inner and reflective. And reflective, and some pick up on the humor more, and they want to have a good time.
Right. Oh my God! So you're constantly
shifting emphasis. Feed, I would say.
What is the word? Being fed by it.
There's a reciprocal response that always happens.
Yeah.
That is continuing to happen.
You know, it's interesting. And
that's the other thing I want to say.
Yeah.
Before I forget it, is that just my whole approach to acting is. Pretty much to approach an audience and other actors as equals, that we are...
In it together.
In it together. And this is different from another school of acting, which I would say is more to impress, to
I have
together,
something to show you, to give you, and here it is.
There is some dynamic, and there's some dazzling pyrotechnics that actors can do. That are astonishing and are very impressive, and I was just never as interested in that kind of acting.
Is that part of your training, as well as part of who you are?
Maybe it is. I mean, my training, I had a very terrific teacher, and you know, it's about being real, you know.
Yes.
And if it isn't real, it doesn't much matter.
Because the other thing is really manipulative, isn't it?
It kind of is.
Yeah, it's I act on you.
Dig me rather than get involved in the story.
Yes.
And I'm just part of this story.
And really what you were saying earlier, it seems to me, is what informs that. And that is the significance of the stories as it has to do with the way human beings interact and relate to one another. That's really what's important to you.
Yeah.
That's what you're doing.
It's how we treat each other.
Yes,
in the final
right.
Analysis.
But not everybody has that point of view as an actor.
No. No, not everyone has anybody else's point of view, really.
I mean,
everyone has their own point of view. I'm more comfortable with that one, I would say, than with others. I think there are other points of view that are completely as valid and look at the world just a little differently, and I just don't understand it as well. When I approach a scene, there are probably 12, 14 different ways to play it, and I'm only smart enough to think of maybe three or four.
You're a really nice man.
Thanks.
So anything else about being an artist?
I'll tell you one thing that's happened to me is because I get older. I mean, I'm in my 60s, that I appreciate the other arts more and more. I just have become a huge fan of stuff that I never was as a young man, of dance. And I've always loved literature and writing and reading. But all the arts now. I love museums. Sculpture and painting, more and more. I just think
you're expanding.
I am expanding my appreciation as my own powers diminish. I think I'm appreciating more.
Don't do that.
Oh well, it's sometimes very difficult to get out of bed in the morning, and that just wasn't true, you know, 25 years ago after you do a performance.
Well, I hear that, and I want to tell you that I watched you and I thought, how the hell is he doing this?
Well, that's right.
No kidding.
Well, last year was also a challenge. I did The Imaginary Invalid last year.
I didn't see it.
And playing Icon, and there was some singing and dancing, which I don't do, but I did it anyway.
If it's an actor's work.
Yes, I did it, but I don't do it, you know?
Yeah,
any singer or dancer would know, that's not singing and dancing. I said, I'm not very good at it. And Craig would say, well, just do the best you can and it'll be just right.
Yes, I'm sure it was perfect for the character.
Bob, probably.
I'm sure it was.
I'm sure it was.
This
was painful. It's supposed to be very good, Doc. You'll be perfect for it.
That's very cute. That's very cute. Okay, so, all right. I mean, I could talk to you all day, but I know that you have things to do.
It's my day off. I only do it.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Let me take you out of your misery here and send you on your way.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Doug. I really appreciate it.
Anytime.
Be careful what you say.
So there you have Doug Jones. And as is glaringly apparent from that interview, an incredibly thoughtful, professional actor who takes his business, the business of acting, really seriously, has a profoundly important philosophy about what it means to be an actor, and brings that to every performance. And I hope that you have been intrigued enough both by Doug's interview and what we said about the plays and Sharon's review to get yourselves to the Oslo Repertory Theater and see Perfume Shop and Hearts. Very, very different plays. Very, very wonderful theater. As promised, I am going to play both of Sharon's reviews in this show. I played the review of Perfume Shop before Doug's interview, and now I'm going to play her review of Heart.
Hi, this is Sharon Leslie with my review of Hearts. Ten hut, line up outside the Oslo box office. Buy a ticket to see Hearts, one of the best recent plays about the effects of World War II on its veterans. Hearts is so good it was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, so laugh, cry, and be swept into the story of Donald Waldman, an aging World War II war veteran, as he battles his spreading waistline, plays cards with his buddies, cares for his wife and family, and tries to find ways to calm his heart and soul when his war memories invade his sleep and his life. While all this may sound like the hype you read on the back of a DVD cover, this play is actually written by a son about his father, a real son, Willie Holtzman, about his real father. Names are changed for the play, but the essence of the story is rooted in a life lived. I read the play before I saw it. I was amazed at how well it transferred to the stage. The plot line is not linear. It skips around like a person's memories. As the story unfolds between the past and the present, we learn more and more about Waldman's life and the secrets he has been keeping deep inside. While the language is colorful, it's also working class, army barrack authentic. The playwright Holtzman doesn't hold back on the less than appealing aspects of being a soldier in the trenches. Doug Jones, as Donald Waldman, almost never leaves the stage. He gives an impressive portrayal of the tormented veteran. He brings humor, pathos, and a soldier-warrior mentality to his performance. He is marvelous. The other actors on the stage create well-defined characters and all work well as an ensemble. The direction by Greg Leeming is taut and the transition smooth. He makes sure we in the audience know what is going on as it skips around. The pivotal scene in the second act, which I don't want to reveal, is haunting. The production itself has a visual theatricality that engages and sets the mood. The set by Judy Galen is multi-leveled and shaped. The set functions well through its multiple places and times. The light and sound effects give the impression of wartime battles, as well as peacetime Brooklyn. The lighting by James Sale is quite spectacular and evocative. I hope you will find a way to see Hearts. I think that seeing this story on the stage will be more effective than if it ever gets to the movies. Hearts is really, really good theater.
Okay, so there you have it. Reviews of two very different shows. Pretty much all they have in common is that they are both wonderful, interesting, and compelling in their own ways. And the interview with Doug, which I believe gives a real perspective on these shows. So I hope that if you are living close enough to come on down and see both of those shows, you will. And if you've always thought of coming to Florida and you haven't, get on a plane. It's a little chilly here now, but it's a little chilly everywhere, and we will get the sunshine back very soon. And these plays are both playing until April. So do try and get to them. Next week, I'm playing an interview with Michael Joseph Mitchell, who is also in these three plays. And so, as no two people are exactly alike, you get his take on what it is like to do these three shows. Before I stop, I need, as always, to thank the intrepid Josh Hackney, who is my IT guru, who makes these shows sound as good as they possibly can. Glitches are my fault, success, all Josh's. And who saves me in every conceivable way. Anything that has to do anything with computers, IT, recording, electronics. Just a genius. And also kind and dependable. So if you have issues with any of these things, you want Josh. And go, oh my gosh, I never gave my website, did I? Well, here I am. My website is thelynshow.com. thelynneshow. thelynshow.com. Don't forget the E in Lynn. You get a different person if you don't. And you can click on email me and ask for Josh, or you can click on email me and ask me any questions, make any comments, pretty much say anything you want. So as always, I hope you got something from this show that you wanted. Something that intrigued you or interested you, something you can use, something you didn't know, something you knew that you forgot. Just something that makes you want to come back, because I will be here next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retired. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang, so you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten limper, but I won't.
Hi, this is Sharon Leslie with review of The Perfume Shop. Sweet florals, tangy citrus, spicy herbals, and animal musks are the various scents one might attribute to the storyline of The Perfume Shop. This charming play, written in 1937 by Hungarian playwright Miklós László, is getting its first English language production in the United States with a deliciously delightful production at the Oslo Repertory Theater. You may have already seen several versions of this play made into films like The Shop Around the Corner, In the Good Old Summertime, and most recently the loose adaptation, You've Got Mail. But the original is worth seeing. Watching The Perfume Shop made me appreciate the artistry of a good playwright. It's hard to write a romantic comedy with charm, wit, and humanity. This play has differences from the films that are appealing, and the characters come alive as portrayed by the Oslo actors. Foremost is Paul Whitworth as Miklós Hammerschmidt, the perfume shop owner. The character has to go through some fairly tough issues. Whitworth embodies the wide range of emotions that his character goes through with ease and appeal. He makes it easy for us in the audience to identify with Hammerschmidt's problems. Jason Bradley sparkles as the young man who has fallen in love with his girl pen pal, whom he has never met, or so he thinks. Mackenzie Kyle brings passion to her portrayal of the woman he is writing to, but hates in person. Other notables are Ghafir Akbar as the young bicycle delivery boy. He energizes the stage and fills the production with a marvelous sense of comic style. Also, Doug Jones as the passive-aggressive older clerk adds a different dimension to the story aspects with the comings and goings in and out of the perfume shop. The set by Jeffrey Dean is evocative of the 1930s in Eastern Europe, displaying the soft beauty yet functionality of a perfumery. Costumes by Virgil Johnson are gently period and lovely to watch. What I liked the most was the charm and humanity that came through, first with the play, and then with the actors as they brought their characters to life. Like a sweet yet tangy scent, The Perfume Shop should please most anyone who goes to see it.